And welcome to Holden Village. Today is Monday, July 22nd, 2002. Today's session is titled Luke's Fascination with 40, Luke's Journey to Jerusalem, the First Lenten 40, and it is presented by Fred Strickert. The number is STF 2002-06. Let's listen in.
I need to signal people the tape room. You can roll the tape. I have to do that every morning, so it's not that I'm crazy. I just say start the tape. But that way they get the thing going. I'm glad to see so many here today. I saw a lot of people heading off on the hiking trails, and I'm kind of worried. But we've got a good group here, it looks like, this morning. And I hear you all talking, and I hope you keep up here talking as we go along and share your ideas. My name is Fred Strickert. I teach biblical studies at Wartburg College in Waverly, Iowa. And I'm here for the two-week period doing the Bible studies. I was here last week, and so this is my second week. And what's interesting about things is there's such a turnover. I see a few faces that are familiar from last week, and some of you are a bit new. Come on in. Just be careful for the cord. When Barb asked me to do a Bible study, I wanted to do something on the Gospels and just give you a little bit of introduction about why I decided to do for a theme. This is the 40th year anniversary for Holden, and it's 40 years in the wilderness, and I decided, well, how can I kind of make a connection? And so I simply turned to a concordance, which is a book that has all, you can look up every single word and has all the uses. And so looking up 40, the word 40 occurs 117 times in the Bible. That seems like it's always showing up in the Old Testament. And in Genesis, you have the flood, 40 days and 40 nights. And you get to the books of Exodus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy. This is where most of the 40s occur, and it's references to that 40 days of wandering. When I switch over to the New Testament, I kind of surrounded those in purple here, just to kind of highlight them. There's not so many references, and I immediately went to the Gospels. That's what I wanted to do. And the interesting thing is it's never in John. John never mentions any 40. And when it comes to Matthew, Mark, and Luke, basically the only 40 is tied in with the temptation story. The temptation in the wilderness, 40 days. And that's pretty much it. And I thought, well, maybe I'm going to have to look elsewhere for a theme. But what surprised me is then I went to the book of Acts. And wow, there's a whole bunch of references to 40 here. And on the assumption that Luke is the author of Acts, so Luke writes Luke and Acts, this seems to be an interest of his. And so I went back through the book of Luke and came up with 10 lessons or 10 sessions on Luke and the 40 in the wilderness. And sometimes this means that it's going to be kind of imposed and artificial. It's not a natural kind of thing. But sometimes doing it that way gives you new insights. I'm just going to kind of run through kind of what we're doing, just what we have been doing the last 40 weeks. I titled the series Luke's Fascination with 40. So the first day, we talked about from Jesus to the Gospels. And what's interesting is that there was a gap from the time of Jesus to the writing of the Gospels, which was 40 years. And we talked about that as that transition time is, in a sense, wilderness time. Wilderness people operate more with oral traditions and oral proclamation, and settled people more with written documents. We talked a bit about that. And then we picked up on the wilderness experience in terms of the temptation stories. And that's really fascinating because, of course, that's one story many of you, I'm sure, are very familiar with, because it's read every year, first Sunday in Lent. And you have Satan tempting Jesus three times, and three times Jesus quoting the Old Testament. What's interesting about that is all three of the quotations of Jesus come from one short little section, Deuteronomy chapter 6 to 8. And the focus on what it meant to be in the wilderness and how God was testing the people, and they had manna in the wilderness and never went without. So that's all tied in with the wilderness tradition here. We have seats in the back over here. We can get by. And two up here in the front. What? That's the dangerous thing. Okay. We'll break it. Then, one that really is tied in with 40, Luke, in his infancy stories, has a reference to Jesus being presented in the temple, which was always done on the 40th day. Although he doesn't say the 40th day. But we look at that particular story. Jesus turns 40 days old. And then, last week, we looked at the emphasis on the age of Jesus as being 30. Well, Luke talks about that. And that's kind of a contrast, because Moses, of course, is 40 when he begins, and the emphasis on the 40 and why 30. And what was interesting, going back to Numbers, the book that talks about the wilderness tradition, in Numbers there's a census, and for most of the tribes, it's people over the age of 20 when they're able to fight. That's how they started counting them. But when it came to the Levites, the people who are in service of the Lord, the interesting thing is that they were counted from 30 to 50. And there may be something there. So we looked at that. We looked at Hellenistic traditions about age as well. And then last week on Friday, we talked about the Galilean ministry of Jesus. And the interesting thing is how often Jesus is described as retreating back to the wilderness, going to a deserted place, a lonely place, sometimes a mountain, to pray in that busy schedule. So it's not just wilderness and then settled life, but it's an interaction, just as we retreat to the wilderness to be energized and to reflect. This week, today we're going to be talking about the journey to Jerusalem, and I won't go into detail about that because you get plenty of that today. Tomorrow we'll talk about the last temptation and how Luke's way of describing Jesus' experience in Jerusalem in a way goes back and looks at the temptation by Satan again. So we'll look at that tomorrow. When it comes to the resurrection, only Luke mentions that the resurrection accounts that the appearances of Jesus occur in a 40-day period of time. So we'll look at that and think about that. And then the person who speaks the most about 40 years is a surprise, because it's this Hellenist Stephen, who interestingly is somebody who has come from the outside, probably not somebody who was born in and around Jerusalem, but he's called a Hellenist, a Greek speaker. And in his speech, in his trial, he refers to the 40 years four different times. So we'll be picking up on that. That's actually when we move to Friday. Thursday, we will have a Bible study just on the concept of Jubilee. That's our Jubilee day. So we're going to be meeting at 8:30, and I'm going to be talking about Luke and connections with the whole Jubilee theme. So anyway, that's where I have come from, and that's where I'm planning to go this week. Today we're talking about the journey of Jerusalem to Jerusalem. And, this may be a little bit too small for me, but can you all see this board at all, or should I just summarize? I don't know.
Can you pull it forward about a foot?
I can pass it. Several feet. I have my 2 feet, I'll pull it forward. Okay. You see it now? Okay. I mean, basically what I have here is this kind of outline of Luke's gospel, where you have several different segments. If you divide it up, we could have the infancy part here, but a Galilean ministry of Jesus, which really is the bulk of material about Jesus. How many years, anywhere from 1 to 3 years of ministry. And that's described in chapters 4 to 9. And then, at the end, of course, is the Jerusalem experience, which is 1 week of Jesus' life. The death and passion, death and resurrection. And that goes from chapters 19 to 24. And smack dab in the middle, what I have here is the journey. That's what I want you to see, the journey. The journey to Jerusalem, which, of course, all the Gospels have a section that gets Jesus from Galilee to Jerusalem. I mean, you've got it got to go from north to south. And all the Gospels mention that, that Jesus leaves Galilee and makes his way to Jerusalem. But Luke makes that a primary focus in his Gospel. He does it in a couple ways, by starting in chapter 9, when the day is drawn near for him to be received up, he set his face to go to the Jerusalem. So it makes it clear, I'm moving into another section. But what's striking about that section lasts 9 or 10 chapters. The journey to Jerusalem, 9 or 10 chapters. So it's really out of proportion. Several years in Galilee took up 5 chapters. And now this journey is about 40% of the gospel. So there's something that Luke is really emphasizing in that journey. From a source critical perspective, the assumption is Luke made use of the Gospel of Mark. When Luke was writing his Gospel, Mark was already published out there, and Luke had Mark's Gospel before him. And there are times by very careful analysis, even the specific order of certain stories, the wording, it's quite clear that Luke borrows material of Mark, but then he shapes it by inserting his own stories. And what's interesting is that basically the first 6-7 chapters of Mark are parallel here in the first part of Luke, and then the last 8 chapters in the last part of Luke, but the part of the journey, we don't really have very many parallels there in Mark. So Luke got his material from other places. I put down Q here. That's a common hypothetical source. Common, many scholars believe that there was a book out there that had sayings of Jesus that were taken over both by Luke and by Matthew. It's a book that disappeared. So I color-code that in red, and then blue is kind of unique stuff that Luke has picked up on. And so he inserts those stories. He has made the decision to add that to Mark's Gospel. So when he picks those individual stories, it's not just, okay, I need to fill up space, but these stories provide important themes that I want people to understand in this whole Gospel. And as we go along, we can see that basically, chapter 9, going all the way down to chapter 19, it comes together with the entry into Jerusalem on Palm Sunday, that once again, we have Matthew, Mark, and Luke having parallels, but here we don't have parallels. But as Jesus goes on the road, Luke continually emphasizes that idea. We're on a journey, and we're thinking about that journey as we're making our way to Jerusalem. And in a way, connected it to the 40, it's similar in a way to the Israelite people making their journey to the promised land. And it'll end up, the last story here will be the story of Zacchaeus and Jericho, which of course is the first place where the Israelites come. But as it parallels the wilderness experience of Israel, it looks ahead to the experience of the church, where every year we have our 40 days of Lent. And as we make our journey to Jerusalem, our own journeys, we look at what's important in our own lives, and we evaluate that. And I think that's kind of what Luke is doing here. And so he constantly reminds people, don't forget, we're on a journey. Now as they went on their way. One of the things you immediately see that I happen to kind of pick up here is that it seems that the journey emphasizes the inclusive character of the gospel. Talks about going through Samaria and Galilee, and includes people who are often often disenfranchised, the Samaritans. And includes a stopover at Mary and Martha's house. Includes connections with, or focus on the role of women in ministry. This is a sheet that I put together one time that just has favorite stories only in Luke, which is, we're looking at the Mark and stuff, and then all the stuff that's added in, what you end up having here, these are all stories that are only in this gospel. And these are stories that occur here in this section of the journey. Careful of the cord here. But these are sections that are only in the journey stories that we only have in Luke, which, I mean, when you look at them, some of these stories, wow, if, you know, if we didn't have Luke's gospel, the Good Samaritan, Mary and Martha, Prodigal Son, all these we wouldn't have. But what you see, if one way of looking at this is by looking at the content and what are in these stories. Again, it's kind of this focus on the inclusiveness. One of the first stories is a mission of the 70, in which Jesus sends out 70 followers to preach and teach. Now, all the Gospels have a Jesus sending out the 12 disciples. And they go out and they practice preaching and teaching. All the Gospels have that. It's in Mark, and Luke has that also in chapter 9 in the Galilean part. But the very next chapter, then he has a similar kind of thing with the 70. And for, I mean, one thing it says, there were more disciples than just the 12. But the other thing, the number 12 and the number 70, the number 12 is really symbolic of Israel. And you kind of think of the 12 disciples and their roles with Israel. But the number 70 in the ancient world often signified the whole world. There was a theory that there were like 70 languages altogether. And so this is a foreshadowing of the Gentile ministry at the beginning of the journey. And I mentioned before the role of women. So you have the story of Mary and Martha. Interestingly, we have a bunch of parables here with women as the main characters. So a woman with the lost coin. You could also have the woman with baking bread. The parable of the widow and the judge. Oftentimes you look at Mark or Matthew, and the parables are basically main characters are men. Kings, fathers, farmers, fishermen, those are the main characters in a lot of the parables. Luke's gospel, there's also parables with women as the main character. What that tells us, of course, is that there's a lot of women in the audience. And you direct your parables to those people who are around you. So that suggests, you know, this inclusive group making their way to Jerusalem. We have a story of the Good Samaritan, and also the 10 lepers who were healed, and only one is thankful, and by the way, that was a Samaritan. So emphasis on other groups coming into the picture, and also a focus on the poor, the rich man and Lazarus, and the poor being part of that community. Now, what I am going to be doing here, I gave you a handout. One way of looking at the journey is by looking at the contents. And we could spend a lot of time looking at all these stories. Today, I'm going to look at it in a totally different way I've never looked at before. And this is the handout you have. And I stopped. I put some handouts up there. Do you all have some handouts?
Do you have any extras?
Maybe. Let's see. If you see some on chairs, I have a few more here. I think we have enough over here. Do you need a couple upstairs?
Yeah, there's a few here.
Oh, okay. Okay. So pass them around if anybody needs any. What I'm doing here, we're looking at the story of the women at the cross, which... Okay, wait, we're on the journey, and we look at the story of the cross. But what I'm doing here, what Luke does, it's kind of interesting. If we look at the journey part of the story, I mean, we can look at the contents, but Luke does something that's kind of interesting that occurs frequently in the Gospels. We have what's called a sandwich technique. And you can understand one story by placing it within another story. So you have part of that story at the beginning and part at the end. And so, on the sheet that I passed out, there's a story about the women disciples, and that occurs just before the beginning of the journey, and then at the end of the journey in Jerusalem. And that may help to highlight some of the basic themes for traveling to Jerusalem. So we're going to start at the very end, the witnesses at the crucifixion, which is what I have up here at the top of your page. This is presented in all four Gospels at the cross of Jesus, at the point where Jesus has died. Centurion is there and says, and Mark's Gospel says, truly this is the Son of God. At that point, you get this interesting reference. We'll start with Mark because that's the earliest. Oh, and by the way, there were also women looking on from a distance. among them, and then their name, Mary Magdalene, and Mary, the mother of James the younger, and Joses, and Salome. And I actually didn't decide on this in advance. I didn't think of this, but today happens to be the day marked for Mary Magdalene in the calendar. I don't know if you're aware of that. So I guess I was thinking ahead somehow subconsciously looking at this text. We're going to learn from Mary Magdalene today. And some of the other women. Now, what's interesting about this, of course, is that by this time, the other disciples have gone into hiding. The other disciples, the male disciples, are not there at the cross. And so the women play an important role as being the ones who have remained there to the very end. They have journeyed from Galilee all that way, and they are the ones who have continued to the end. And what's kind of odd with Mark is Mark hasn't prepared us for that. If you ever read the Gospel of Mark all the way through, this comes as a total surprise. And so he has to put in this little comment in 41. These used to follow him and provided for him when he was in Galilee. He forgot to tell us that back when Jesus was traveling on Galilee. He didn't mention Mary Magdalene as being part of the story. Mary, the mother of Jesus, is mentioned, which we assume this is probably he's referring to here. Mary, the mother of Jesus, is in a couple stories. And Salome, we don't have any character like that. Mark never mentioned that. And there's a handful of stories, very few stories in Mark's gospel, which women were the major characters, but usually they're unnamed. We don't know who they are. And they're just isolated stories. But now Mark is saying, by the way, all along, these women have been here behind the scenes. We just have never seen them. These used to follow him and provided for him when he was in Galilee. And there were many other women, too, we could have added to this story, who had come with him to Jerusalem. So, point number one is, even though we're beyond the journey, the emphasis here is these were women who were part of that journey to Jerusalem. The choice of language in Mark is kind of significant. Used to follow. They used to follow back in Galilee. And they used to follow, I'm not sure when I think of how that's translated, used to follow almost sounds like they did before, but they don't now. I mean, in a way, okay, Jesus has died, but they have followed to the very end. But really, what you have here is a tense in Greek that's, I mean, it's called the imperfect tense, and a few of you have probably taken Greek, but in Greek there's a number of different past tenses, and this tense that's called the imperfect is used when you want to say something continued to happen. And so you could say they continually followed him would be a good translation. Or often you can throw in something like they regularly followed him. They customarily followed him. That would be a good translation. They did it all the time. It wasn't just a couple times back then. And what's odd here is that Matthew, when he takes this over, he changes it to a different past tense. It's almost like it's a one time. They had followed him. As if it's kind of an end time, or it's something that's finished. But here is the, you know, continually following. And the other word here, and provided for him. And we're going to spend a lot of time now talking about the word provided for him. The RSV translation, this is new RSV. The RSV had ministered to him. I know some of you have Bibles there. I don't know if you have any other translations that you have here on this one. But the RSV had ministered to him. Here has provided with him. The Greek word that's used here is diakonoun, which comes from the root word which we use for deacon or diaconal. Someone who provides diaconal kind of service. And that would be a big theme in Acts when the seven Hellenist deacons are picked. And we'll talk about that later in the week. But what's interesting in Mark's gospel, that verb occurs only about three or four times. One other time it's used of a woman. Peter's mother-in-law. You have this one day after the Sabbath service, they go to Peter's mother-in-law for lunch, and she has a fever, and she's healed, and she ministers to him. Now, in that case, it's kind of an obvious kind of thing. It's a kind of a feeding kind of thing. She gets up and prepares him dinner, which is, you know, kind of an odd kind of thing. But the emphasis, of course, is on him, too, for Jesus. But the other two cases are very interesting. One is in the temptation story. In Mark's version of the temptation story, Mark's story is very brief. It just simply says Jesus was in the wilderness 40 days, not eating. Satan came and tempted him. And then it says, and he was with the wild beasts. Only Mark has that little reference, kind of interesting. In the wilderness with wild beasts. And then it says somebody came and ministered to him.
The angels.
The angels, yeah, angels. And this is kind of, in the wilderness, the angels ministered to Jesus. And here in Galilee and on the journey, it's the women who are ministering to Jesus. And in Mark's gospel, we kind of have to be careful that you don't just simply restrict it to cooking dinner for him. I mean, that's not what the angels were doing in the wilderness. I mean, it just doesn't fit at all. But it's, what kind of ministry would you paint a picture of the, like the angels in the wilderness? He said, and they ministered. And what kind of things would come to your mind?
Consoling?
That's a good word, yeah.
Protecting
him, encouraging him.
Praying for listening. The NIV uses the word cared.
Cared for, okay, good.
Which goes right.
That's, I mean, that was in the wilderness one? Does it, what, do you know what it has?
Well, in the here? Mark, it's cared.
And it has cared for too? Okay. That's good. Yeah, I think it's the way Mark is told. I like the way Mark is told stories. It's not limited to one kind of thing. I said it occurs like about four times. The Peter's mother-in-law, the angels in the wilderness. The other time, the person who is described as following this particular verb is Jesus himself. Mark chapter 10, 45. The Son of Man came not to be served, but to serve. So, I mean, that's the ideal. Jesus is presented, this is the ideal, ministering to other people with all these words that we saw. And the angels did that before, and now, interestingly, it's the women who have this role. The men disciples in Mark's gospel are often individuals that are bungling everything. And the women who have been there all along, who Mark hasn't bothered to mention until the very end, are the ones who have been caring for him, consoling him, encouraging him, all those other kind of words. So that's the way Mark does it. Now, okay, we're talking about Luke, aren't we? So we'll use up all our time on Mark. What Luke has at the cross, a rather short statement, but all his acquaintances, including the women who had followed him from Galilee, but emphasized they had been part of the journey, stood at a distance watching these things. Now, in this text, there's no mention of, well, what were the women doing all along? Part of that is because Luke had already talked about the women. Mark doesn't introduce them earlier, so he has to put that information. Matthew doesn't introduce them earlier. But in chapter 8, Luke introduced the women after he's talked about Jesus calls 12 disciples. And then he says, soon afterward, he went on through the cities and villages proclaiming and bringing the good news of the kingdom of God. The 12 were with him, as well as some women who had been cured of evil spirits and infirmities. Mary, called Magdalene, from whom 7 demons had gone out. And Joanna, the wife of Herod's steward, Cusa, and Susanna, and many others. And I wonder how many are the many. And then you get who provided for them out of their resources. Now, does that put a little bit of a different twist? Provided out of their resources. When you say resources, what are you starting to think of when you say provided out of the resources?
Bought things for him to provide for him.
Bought things?
With their money. With their own money.
So it's things that are, that you can put a money standard on, figure, material things, and that sort of thing.
there were people of resource.
There were people who had the resources they could share.
It also suggests to me basic physical needs, food and clothing.
How about physical needs? Okay, Jesus is, I mean, on the long journey, you think of the wilderness experience of Israel, 40 years in the wilderness and getting by on very little. And Jesus has kind of made this same kind of commitment to make his journey to Jerusalem. And how are they going to find food? I mean, you do get dinners and that kind of stuff, but they're the ones who are going to be showing a spirit of generosity in providing for him. Now, what's interesting, when it talks about and provided for them out of their resources, then the general assumption is these were a bunch of rich women who were following Jesus. They're wealthy. Have you heard that before? They're fairly wealthy. Or, I mean, if they're coming with him. Now, that's a picture that occurs later in Acts, which is kind of interesting, that often in Paul's congregations, the book of Acts will refer to there's a number of fairly well-to-do women that are supporting Paul's ministry. But when you just say provided out of their resources, the resources could be much or little. And that's what I want to pick up on here, because it was kind of a surprise to me, because I've read over the years in all the commentaries, and you kind of get these pictures of women as, you know, they're wealthy women, they can do this kind of thing. You know, what does that say for, as a model for common people, and what they can do with their resources? Just a little word study here. The word that's used as resources, I wrote down the word possessions. Basically what I did is I went to a Greek concordance and I found that there's a word, hipparchonta, that is what's used here in Luke 8. And here's resources. Sometimes, probably the most times, it's translated as possessions. Sometimes it's property. But the actual word basically comes from, I mean, the verb actually means to exist. And it's kind of what you need for your existence, which we all have. What you basically need to exist in society. The word at the beginning, it's a hippo kind of preposition, is that which kind of undergirds your life and makes it possible for you to exist on a day-to-day basis. And that can be interpreted, I mean, for all of us, you know, it's not the same thing. Some people exist on some amount of resources, some on other amounts. So it applies to anybody, no matter what, you know, what the level here. Now, I'm going to look at the other side of it. I look at that word, and I look at the word wealth. And this is what it's often interpreted as. These were wealthy women, but it never says they're wealthy women. Luke is very much conscious about concerns about wealth and poverty. And I could have done a similar word study with the word poverty or the poor in Luke, and I think it would have found it a lot of times. But I just simply looked up the word wealth, both a noun, verb, to become wealthy, or an adjective, a rich person. And it's interesting, in the Gospels, that term occurs 21 times in all the Gospels. But when you count them up, 14 of those are in Luke. Two-thirds. There's four Gospels. You'd think it's, okay, about 5, 5, 5. Two-thirds of the times, there's references to wealth. It's in Luke's Gospel. He's really concerned about that. And where in his Gospel, of those 14 times, 10 of them are on the journey. Mm-hmm. Well, they're on the journey. And, you know, when you think carrying everything that they needed in their backpacks, and same as, you know, taking a journey up to Holden Lake or wherever, when you're doing that, you don't think in terms of wealth that much on the journey, but you kind of think, what I need for this particular journey. It's interesting that there are these frequent references here. We're prepared already at the beginning of the Gospel with the Magnificat, which only Luke has. So Mary talks about how God lifts up the poor in their low estate and brings down the wealthy. And we're also prepared in the Beatitudes in the Galilean section, where in the Beatitudes, in Matthew's Gospel, you know, the Sermon on the Mount is, and blessed are the poor in spirit. But Luke has, blessed are the poor, more in a material kind of way. And then Luke also adds the opposite, something that's not in Matthew's Beatitudes: woe to those who are rich, who are wealthy. But then the majority of these 10 times occur as they're making their journey. And part of this is Jesus encounters people who are wealthy and want to join the journey. And you have some who come, like the rich young ruler, who figures, it's not worth giving up my wealth to join in the journey. And others, like Zacchaeus, who encounter Jesus and say, this is for me. So as far as all these references here. So it seems like the journey is a kind of thinking about wealth. But not just wealth. So we think that, okay, maybe this doesn't apply to most of us who don't like to define ourselves as wealthy. Although we think in terms of the rest of the world. Okay, that's another thing. But this word possessions occurs 16 times in the New Testament, half of which are in Luke. And then if we added Acts, that would be 10 of the 16 times are written by Luke, concerned about possessions. But most of them, again, 7 of them, occur on the journey. The only time here in the Gospel of Luke we don't have reference to possessions is what we just looked at, the reference to the women providing. And that then provides the entree into the journey, so we can have this long discussion here on the journey about the role of possessions, just as we do in our own Lenten seasons. We talk about, okay, what do we need to exist? What do we need in our life? I should just pause for a little bit here. I've just been presenting, and it's good to have your insights on some of this.
Just a question back about 20 minutes ago. You mentioned that in Mark, that the men scattered and the women stayed.
The men
scattered or went away and the women stayed. Was that also, let's say this when they came across the line, was that also cultural? The women were not in any danger to be associated with Jesus and the men may have been?
Yeah, and there are different reasons, you know, why was that the case? I mean, one thing is simply be that, yeah, the men would have been in danger, and they would have assumed that they could have easily been rounded up to, and maybe the women not so much. That's a reason. Interestingly, when that particular text is, remember reading some material from Latin American women studying the Gospels, and they looked at it and they said, oh, it's obvious women have more courage, and they're speaking out. And that's from their own experience in Latin America, where, you know, women were also on the line. Right. And so, you know, I don't, you know, how much they would have been there, you know, we have to look at it and kind of evaluate it and make our own interpretation. So, yeah. But they, I mean, the story was that the men weren't there for whatever reasons it was, and the women were there. And you have to draw your conclusions on that. Any other insights people kind of see with, you know, the wealth and the possessions? And
the word resources, is that the compartmentalized? That is the word.
Yeah, that's this word.
Possession.
But here, for some reason, when they translate it, they use the word resources, and it could have been their well-to-do, but it could have been, you know, whatever they had, they were the ones who had that insight to begin sharing, whatever it was.
Again, the NIV uses the word means instead of resources.
Means. Okay, now, when you think of means,
it's whatever you have.
Whatever. Okay, so it's not necessarily a lot, but it's whatever you have.
It reminds me of the parable of the widow with her means.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's the 2 coins and that sort of thing. Anyone else, any thoughts that you have? When we look at this, you kind of get the model then set on the journey about the priorities. And if we go back up to the top of the page, then you get these 2 references in Acts. And what's interesting is this becomes the model for the early church, how they operated when they were no longer on the journey. And so the story of the early Christians in Jerusalem, all who believed would sell their possessions and goods and distribute them, the proceeds, to all who had need. And no one claimed private ownership of any possessions. And it sounds like then this became not just in Jerusalem, but this became the model of the early church. The only other two times it's referred to, Hebrews is fairly late in the New Testament. It talks about people who cheerfully accepted the plundering of their possessions, people undergoing persecutions, and, you know, their possessions, what they need for daily life, but having the attitude of cheerfulness, partly because of this kind of experience here. And then, of course, Paul in the famous love chapter, you know, if I give away all my possessions but don't have love, I mean, the whole focus on the love motive behind all of this. Maybe looking at the time here, just one final episode I think I will look at. The story of Zacchaeus is the end story, and this is the last one along the journey. As you have this constant focus on what does it mean to have possessions, what can you give up? Just prior to that, there's the whole section about the rich young ruler who has come and says, I want to follow. What must I do? And Jesus says, sell your possessions and give. Essentially, he says, sell your possessions and give alms to the poor. And then it talks about how he then went away very sad because he was rich. He had a lot. And that's kind of interesting. Sell your possessions, the little thing, but the more you have, the more difficult it is to give away is kind of the message there. And then you get the whole discussion about it's easier for a camel to go through the eye of a needle than a rich man in the kingdom of heaven, and that sort of thing. But then you get, the very last things you get, Jesus and Zacchaeus, which is a story that we're all familiar with, partly because, he's described as this, as what is the wee little Zacchaeus, and Zacchaeus in Sunday school very, very early on. But what's interesting about the way he's depicted, basically, we're told three things about him at the beginning, where Zacchaeus is described. He's a chief tax collector. He was rich. And then it talks about his stature, short of stature. And, of course, what happens is, on this occasion, then Jesus comes to his house. He's on the journey. He comes to his house. And, of course, the interesting thing there is Zacchaeus then shows hospitality in what he has. That's kind of the first step in inviting the stranger and providing from his own resources. But then what happens is after the experience with Jesus, you end up Zacchaeus making his commitment. After his encounter with Jesus, he's a changed man. Look, half of my possessions, Lord, I will give to the poor. And if I have defrauded anyone of anything, I will pay back four times as much. Now, doing the math on that sometimes becomes kind of hard. You just kind of figure out, okay, I'm going to pay people back four times as much, and I'm going to give half of my possessions. I think you need to note here is, okay, here's referring to the possessions, half of what I need. And this may be paying back four times, maybe, you know, that excess that he has accumulated. Maybe that's a way of kind of looking at it. So that he is going to operate not only on, okay, getting rid of all that excess, but then even on what I need on a regular basis, I can get by on half of what I already get by on. So Zacchaeus described three terms, tax collector, rich, and short in stature. The interesting thing about him, that's who he is, that's his identity. But he gets beyond all of those things. He gets beyond being short, by climbing up a tree. He gets beyond being a tax collector by being a distributor of wealth instead of a tax collector. And he gets beyond being wealthy by sharing his possessions with other people around the world. So Zacchaeus is totally transformed by this experience to be someone who looks at his own existence and What do I need to exist in life? And for him, half of my possessions, half of what I normally get by on, which is, you know, if you think of it, I mean, I could easily get by on half of what I have, or a quarter, or who knows. So, thoughts, comments, please.
What's the tense and the verbs of verse 8? In the New King James Version, it's in the present indicative.
Would you just read it there in the illustration?
It says, Zacchaeus stood and said to the Lord, "Look, Lord, I give half my goods to the poor. And if I have taken anything from anyone by false accusation, I
rather than will.
Right.
So, yeah, present, yeah.
Both verbs are in the present.
And I don't have the Greek Bible in here, so I can't check it out. I mean, is he doing something right there to say, hey, you know, this isn't just a pledge that, you know, when you leave, and you're not going to be here, but, you know, is he doing something right there? You know, you have the crowds around him and all this kind of stuff, and, you know, is he starting, not just waiting for next week when the stock market goes up that he can sell and not be so much of a loss? But anyway, yeah. Yeah, and that's interesting that that's a trend. Does anybody else have a translation of parables? That's what, NIV?
New King James.
Or New King James.
Whatever the Gideons gave us.
Okay. We have an NIV over here. I don't know if anybody has other translations. This is New RSV. But I give. It's kind of, yeah, I'm starting it now. I can't wait till tomorrow.
But doesn't it all imply I give? I'm already doing it?
You mean I,
that's how I hear it.
Yeah. Oh, I see.
Like I'm already doing this. I don't like it.
Yeah.
I don't think that's what it meant.
It seems to suggest that's his present practice.
Okay. I was. Yeah, I'm sorry.
That's the same as NIV too has that.
But I give. How do you normally?
It actually says here and now. I give half. In NIV. And then where he talks about repaying four times where he's cheated, that's future.
Okay, that's
future. I will pay back four times.
When he says, I mean, when he says here and now, I mean, from this moment on, it's not already I give, but it's from this moment.
Mm-hmm.
Now that's in NIV. That's not in New.
This is here I give.
Here.
What would the different, which tenses would indicate those two different? Beginning now, or is it the state?
Well, I mean, it could. You'd have to have a word like already to say that it's already been happening. If you're using the present tense, I think. I mean, present can be very vague. I mean, that's the problem in Greek, is it can be, I am giving, or I give right now in the present tense. It could be both tense. It can be vague. So oftentimes you have an extra word thrown in, like already, if it's. It's a continuous kind of thing. Yeah. So I don't know. How do people normally hear this? I mean, this is a story you've heard lots of times.
Well, I hear it as a transformation story.
Right.
That his encounter with Jesus has changed him. Therefore, he will now start a new practice.
Yeah.
And carry on forward. So anything that suggests that he's already doing it, as if he's sort of irritated to suggest that I should be doing something different. All right, I'm doing this already, and now I'm going to give four times as much.
Yeah.
Is satisfied.
And the crowd describes him as a sinner, so if he was already doing all that, that would be...
Yeah, good. Okay. I mean, they're grumbling. Hey, this guy's with this all over.
If you
want
to get
to go over there this year.
Well, it's not that far. I knew where it was. Been there, done that.
You see, I should have made you open it up. Where are we? This is in 8.
I also wonder, too, could it be that when the Lord came to his house, that at that moment, he did have the transformation, because I also read it as a transformation story. And at that moment, I give now. It's not I will give tomorrow, but at this time now, I will give, and I will restore to the others the fourfold.
Yeah.
So I don't know that I see that there's a disconnect between
the interpretations of the word.
Mm-hmm. And the word today seems that, that really is the big word. You know, there's a transformation taking place today. And, that shows up in Luke frequently, thief on the cross. Today, you'll be with me in paradise. And you're a thief. You're dying for this. But now, when you say, remember me.
What I find interesting is that Jesus seems to be accepting this gift of half the possessions now and future payments and forth, but where the rich young ruler demanded all of it right now.
Yeah.
And why the difference by what was acceptable to this and that to the other?
Good question.
But the rich young ruler made no effort to give up anything. Zacchaeus has. I mean, the rich young ruler stood back and said, I can't give this up. He wasn't going to live into it, where Zacchaeus is. I mean, to me, it's like us when a mission appeal comes out and it really touches our hearts, so we'll give something then. But then we kind of go on our merry way and let that fall way into the back. Zacchaeus is saying, now I'll do this, but I will continue to do this in the future. So it's a long-lasting commitment I see in Zacchaeus. And the rich young ruler, I mean, just read the story, but it seems to me he made no attempt to. I mean, he was just struck with what all he had, and he couldn't make an attempt to give it up, and it saddened him that he couldn't. But we don't know what he did down the road, but in the story, we don't know that he gave up anything.
It says, he goes away sad because he's very wealthy. I mean, what you have there, I mean, his wealth is possessing him. And here, by sharing his wealth, it's no longer possessing him. And, I mean, I would assume this is the start. And having that attitude, I mean, he may end up giving it all away. Maybe that's part of it. Just clarification on the Greek here. Sorry. It just is a simple present tense, which is totally ambiguous. And there's no, there's no adverbs in there that are going to, like already, or even here and now, that's all added in there. So, I mean, it often occurs that that's kind of the way you make a statement. I give, and I make a commitment. It's a present tense here. So, it really, it's not going to help us to start.
Please comment just briefly. In my imagination, I'm seeing Jesus's clarity about what's important in life, what's not important, spirituality versus materiality, seems to flow from his decision to go to Jerusalem and all that's entailed in the confrontation that's about to happen. It strikes me that there's a parallel in a lot of lives, Bonhoeffer being one of them. Bonhoeffer's clarity about what's important in life and what's not stems from his decision to go to Jerusalem, in this case, to confront the Third Reich. So I wonder what it means for us in this world to go to Jerusalem, to make that decision first, and then the other clarity seems to come. But I wonder if you can get to the clarity that Jesus has short of deciding to go to Jerusalem.
Where does he how he makes the commitment to go to Jerusalem and
And in that process, then the rest of the clarity seems to be sort of cascading from that decision.
What has occurred just prior to the journey, the key may be the episode of the feeding of the 5,000. Because that's, in the context, in the Gospels, the feeding of the 5,000 comes right after the discussion about the death of John the Baptist. That John the Baptist had made his commitment, and he dies. And that's when Herod Antipas starts asking questions about Jesus. And Jesus retreats to the wilderness, really for the purpose of being alone, trying to find out, what am I to do next? And the interesting thing there, in this place of scarcity, there's the abundance.
Yeah.
And it's really just after that, then that Jesus makes his commitment to go to Jerusalem. And then that's part of that whole story. So that might be the one place that helped shape that. Okay. I noticed by the bell and by the my watch that we are to end around 10 o'clock here. So I hope many of you will come back tomorrow. And what I want to talk about is the experience in Jerusalem. And look really at some connections to the wilderness experience as Jerusalem as being kind of Jesus' own wilderness, but how he finds the feeding and the strength to go on during that particular time. So that's what we're trying to do tomorrow. So thanks all for coming.
Thank you.